You are listening to A Scary State, and this week we're talking about Iowa. So, Nora.
Yes, Lauren.
Let's get scary.
All right. So, Iowa, we don't have any news to catch up on.
I don't think so. We did our updates last week, and then I don't think there's any other true crime stuff.
Okay. All right. Well, then let's jump into Iowa.
Right away.
Okay. Iowa, nicknamed the Hawkeye State, joined the Union on December 28, 1846, and became the 29th state in the U.S. Iowa got its name from the Iowa River, which was named for a Sioux tribe, the American Iowas. Iowa is actually number one in the country for corn production.
I thought it was Nebraska. I don't know what I thought. Oh, yeah, because didn't we... Yeah.
In 2011, 2.3 billion bushels of corn was harvested. That's a lot of corn.
That is a lot of corn.
Some weird laws in Iowa. Mustached men are not allowed to kiss women in public as it is illegal. I don't know about that one. If you live in Iowa, play the piano and only have one arm, you must perform for free. That's horrible. It is illegal to read a person's palms in the city limits of Cedar Rapids.
Have you ever had your palms read?
No, I haven't.
I had mine once in New Jersey, and the lady pretty much said the exact same thing to me as she said to, like, my friend who went right before me. Oh. I was like, dang it.
Give me my money back, woman.
But then, of course, you're like, well, it totally makes a lot of sense. Like, of course what she was talking about is exactly what I'm going through.
Yeah. Ugh. A couple stupid criminals in Iowa. The first is that a woman didn't get along with her father, so she decided to go onto Craigslist and post an ad in an attempt to find a hitman. She offered $10,000 for an unspecified job, and many, many people reached out to her about her ad, including an undercover officer. She openly told every interested person about the hit she wanted.
And obviously she was arrested.
Yeah, and like... I'm sorry, but if someone gives an unspecified job for $10,000, like, there should be alarm bells going
off. Yeah, like, you don't do it.
Exactly. In Carroll, two men decided that they wanted to break into an apartment, and their disguise was fake beards and masks. But for the masks, they just scribbled their faces with black permanent marker, thinking that they would hide their identities. It didn't work.
Oh.
That's literally, like, something a four-year-old would do. One of the most haunted roads in America is located in Iowa. Stony Hollow Road in Burlington is what it's called. And here roams Lucinda, a woman who threw herself to her death after her love didn't show up to their meeting spot. It is said that if you see her and she drops a rose at your feet, you will die the next day.
Oh, geez. Well, maybe don't ever stop on this road.
Yeah. In 1978, residents in Ottoson began hearing strange whistling and screaming coming from the woods. Soon, dogs and cats were found mutilated and killed.
Ew.
Dang. Some people believed it was a Bigfoot-type creature, but nothing has been found.
That's kind of gross. All right, so today, I've got a cryptid for you.
Oh, is this the one you were really excited about?
Yeah, I was really excited about this one.
I can't wait.
All right, so let's travel way back to 1903, the year that The Wizard of Oz premiered on Broadway, Pepsi was first introduced, the Model A from Ford hit the roads, and Crayola crayons were released with 8 whole colors.
Oh my gosh, wait. We started off our podcasts, like our episodes, so similar. Our stories.
Podcast, oh, really?
Yeah, stories.
That's funny. I was like, how did we start our podcast?
Stories.
All right, so it's finally autumn in the nice town of Van Meter, a small town with only about 1,000 residents, and Eugene Griffith, a tool salesman, was making his rounds around the town. He arrived back to Van Meter a little late that night, around midnight, when he noticed something strange. He saw an unusual light on the roof of the Mather and Gregg building, a light that he had never seen before. Griffith immediately thought that this light was from a burglar trying to break into the building, but that thought was quickly dispelled when the light, somehow and very quickly, moved to the other side of the street and was now atop a different building. But before Griffith could do anything about this light, it disappeared altogether. So the next morning of September 29th, the whole town began to hear what Griffith had seen the previous night. He was an established and respected member of the community, so the townsfolk were confused to hear that he was the one telling the tale of this mysterious light. But the town wasn't worried and they weren't scared. Confused? Yeah. But scared? Nope. And because it's fall, the sun set early that night, around 6:30 p.m. Early the next morning, before the sun rose, the town doctor, Dr. Alcott, was startled awake by a very bright light shining in his face. The doctor was in his room, which was actually attached to his office where he practiced. Knowing full well this wasn't a typical light he should be seeing, the doctor ran out of his room to see what the source of this light was. There had been the rumors of burglars sneaking around. He made his way outside and was shocked when he saw where the source of light was coming from. Dr. Alcott could just make out a half-human, half-animal. The creature had the stance of a human with great bat-like wings behind it. In the center of the creature's head was a, quote, single blunt horn, which the light seemed to be emanating from. Dr. Alcott quickly drew his pistol and shot at the monster 5 times, but none of these bullets had any impact on the monster. Quickly realizing that his gun was powerless against it, Dr. Alcott quickly ran back to his office to take cover. The next morning, now September 30th, it was Dr. Alcott's turn to tell a crazy tale. The town was even more in disbelief about his story. Here's the town doctor, a very trusted man, someone who takes care of the town, telling a crazy story about a monster he supposedly saw. The town was abuzz with the news Dr. Alcott had told and the similar tale that Griffith had told just the night prior. Well, early the next morning, on October 1st, see the trend here? Early in the morning.
Also, the description sounds like the Jersey Devil.
A little bit, yeah. Clarence Dunn, known to his friends as Peter, which I don't know how that's a nickname, but whatever, was walking alone through the town. The moon was nothing more than a sliver this night, and the night was cloudy, so Peter didn't have much visibility as he continued his walk. Peter was also well known around the town. After he had graduated from college, he got a job as a cashier at the Van Meter Bank, and to add to his credibility over the next many years, he was promoted to bank manager and soon held many city positions, to include mayor. But at the current time, Peter was just a dude who was in charge of watching over the bank. He was aware of the threat of burglars and wasn't about to let them get into his bank. Peter thought, like Griffith had originally thought, that burglars were the ones responsible for the scary sightings the past few nights. And to make himself feel better and feel safer, Peter had with him his trusty shotgun, which was packed with a load of buckshots. Peter had positioned himself in the bank, ready to fight or scare off any burglars that attempted to break in. Well, around 1 o'clock in the morning, he was startled by a strange noise. He later described the noise as if someone were being strangled. But before Peter could get up to investigate, he was hit in the face by a very strong light that was coming through the front window of the bank. He immediately fired at the light through the window, shattering glass in the process. But the light and the source of the light immediately disappeared. So the next morning, when more was visible, nothing was left of the monster except for a, quote, great three-toed track. And being very smart, Peter took a plaster cast of the monster's tracks. But over time and mysteriously, these casts have vanished. So that evening, everything in the town was normal. I guess Peter didn't tell the whole town about the ordeal he had experienced the previous night because it seemed like no one was believing him. So O.V. White owned a store called Fisher & White that sold hardware and furniture. White's room was at this store, both as a way to keep watch and just because he owned the store, so why not? White was again startled awake by a loud, harsh noise. Probably being aware of the stories of the monster circulating his town, he quickly armed himself and made his way to the window to investigate the source of the noise. Just 15 feet outside of his window, on the telephone pole, sat the monster. White lifted his gun and pulled the trigger, but the monster did not fall off the pole like he had anticipated. No. Instead, it shined a very bright light right at White. All White remembers after he fired the gun was smelling an odor so strong that it, quote, seemed to stupefy him, end quote, but he didn't recall anything else from that night.
Just wait, stupefy?
Stupefy.
I love that word. That's my favorite word.
White, it's your favorite word.
Well, now it is because I've never heard it before.
White's shot did wake up Mr. Sidney Gregg, though, who was sleeping in his store right around the corner from White's shop. That seems to be a common thing where people just, like, live in their stores. Mm-hmm. But, hey, I mean, why not?
Especially in, like, TV shows. Like, the bar owner lives above the bar.
Okay, my dream is to own a bar on the beach and to have, like, a room upstairs. And that's where I sleep. And I just go down and work my bar on the beach.
Oh, my gosh.
It's my dream goal.
That sounds so nice.
I want to so bad. So Mr. Gregg said that he opened his front door to look out at where the gunshot may have come from and said that he saw a monster descending from the telephone pole right on Main Street. I apologize, my dog, we got him a toy and he's obsessed with his toy, so he's just in the background chewing. So, Mr. Gregg described the monster as using his beak like a parrot, which I'm not really sure how that would work, but that's okay.
It's pretty stupefied. Did I use that word right?
Once it reached the ground, it stood fully erect, and Mr. Gregg estimated it to be at least 8 feet tall. He also described seeing a light from its forehead that was as bright as an electric headlight. The monster started to flap its wings, which allowed it to take giant leaps, quote, like that of a kangaroo. At that moment, a familiar noise made its way through the town. Described as fast mail, I later found out this was a mail truck, like a mail train.
Oh.
I've never heard of fast mail before, and I was like, well, that's weird.
Huh.
But it's a mail train. But that was clearly an unfamiliar noise to the monster as it crouched down and began running on all 4 feet in the direction of the old coal mine. It then extended its wings and flew away, disappearing into the night. So by October 2nd, fear had begun to spread and grow around the town of Van Meter. Witnesses were confused about what they had seen, and those listening in were scared of what was unknown. That night, work crews began manning the mine all day and all night. Apparently, for some time, strange noises had been emanating from deep within the mine shafts. The sounds were reported as, quote, though Satan and a regiment of imps were coming forth for a battle.
What?
Like, what? I wonder what that's the sound of. So these sounds hadn't been too concerning, though, because the mine shaft had been shut down for many years at this point, so not many people were near it in the first place anyways. Mm-hmm. But there was a tile and brick factory that was built on the same grounds as this mine, and the factory was still functioning. J.L. Platt Jr., the operations manager, was working at the factory early that morning or late that night, whichever you prefer. Right as 1 a.m. was approaching, he began to hear those strange sounds coming from the mine shaft. These shafts were all really dangerous, too. Some had many twists and turns that led deeper and deeper. Others had just a straight drop-off. Mix the dangerous shafts with the chemical concoctions that were happening in the shaft when it was all up and running, and you just have a really bad combination of what's in these mines. And so it's kind of concerning that these sounds drew Platt closer to the mine shaft. And as he got closer, they seemed to increase in volume. As he finally got near enough to the entrance, Platt saw the monster standing right at the entrance of the cave. And if that wasn't scary enough, there was a smaller one right behind him. Oh, so we have two kids. Of these monsters.
Oh my gosh.
They both produced that very bright light. The two monsters then flew past Platt, who noticed they had, quote, horn-like protuberances, end quote, that were responsible for emanating that bright light. Platt realized in that moment that he may have discovered the monster's lair. Though it was still very early in the morning, word of the sighting spread quickly throughout the town. The men in the village decided that tonight was the night to rid the town of the monsters. They grabbed their most trusted guns and headed toward the monster's lair. As they began making their way to the mines, all the townspeople began turning on their lights. This was in hopes to frighten the monsters off and lend protection to those still at home, because it seemed the monsters were only showing up in places that it was dark.
Mm.
And they were only coming out at night, so, you know, everyone thought, well, all the lights on will be great.
Right.
So a crowd of men began waiting at the mouth of the mine shaft, waiting to ambush the monsters when they arrived. Over 4 hours, the men waited in the cold rain in front of an abandoned mine shaft. But finally, around 5:46 a.m., their waiting paid off. The sun was just starting to rise as one of the men saw, off in the distance, a tall creature with bat-like wings approaching the mine, followed closely behind by the second creature. The men at the mine immediately began shooting at the approaching monsters. Later it was said about the amount of gunshots, quote, reception received would have sunk the Spanish fleet, end quote.
I was going to say, what did they think they were going to do if someone tried shooting it down before?
I don't know. They keep trying to shoot it and they keep being like, oh, the bullets aren't working, but let's just keep trying to shoot at it.
Let's just like bring a huge group into it.
All right. I don't know. In response to the bullets hitting them, the monsters gave off a thunderous and unearthly noise. That peculiar odor that I mentioned earlier was also very present.
Ugh.
But the men soon noticed that, oh my gosh, their bullets did nothing to the monsters.
They're stupidified.
And they flew right past the men and slowly descended into the shaft of the mine. Word immediately spread of the events that occurred at the mine, and the town decided to send a force of men to barricade the mouth of the mine and lock the monsters up once and for all. But it's unknown if they were actually able to barricade the mouth in time before the sun set. Maybe they did, and the creatures are trapped down there forever, left to waste away. Maybe the creatures escaped. We don't know. And the Van Meter visitors have never been seen again.
Wow.
So today, the mine is nothing more than a bowl-shaped depression in the ground. So someone in Van Meter, you can just see this bowl-shaped depression near an old tile factory.
Huh.
What happened to the mine? I don't know. Huh. So some theories have surfaced about what in the world this mysterious monster could be. What we know about the creature is that it stands to be about 8 to 9 feet tall, and it has bat-like wings. It has sometimes been reported as having hooks on the end of its wings, and other times not. It has a three-toed foot. It also has a beak as well as a horn protruding from its forehead. This horn emanates a very, very bright light. The creature makes a truly awful and unsettling noise and is accompanied by a very intense odor. It can walk upright and climb, and it can also fly, and it can fly very fast.
Mm.
Some believe this whole thing was a hoax, but this has been disproved because many respected members of the society were the ones who came forward about the monster. There is also no financial benefit that this town received when the stories came about. So why, you know, why would they have this random thing that they say happened in their town?
If anything, it would, like, damage their reputation.
Yeah, exactly. And also of those people who talked about it, you know, they're like these respected men in the community. Right. You have a doctor, a guy who owns a hardware store, a guy who ends up becoming mayor later. Like, why would they say something that could damage their reputations? Yeah. Some believe this creature could be related to the tales of a humanoid thunderbird that comes from the Ayoaya tribe. This thunderbird was known to be able to shoot lightning from its eyes.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, we have the light coming from the eyes.
Yeah.
Others say it was a prehistoric creature that was finally released by the miners. So it was trapped down in this mine, and when the miners came and were opening up caves and stuff and shafts, it just released this animal.
Wow.
Maybe it's a UFO and took the shape of a bird in a time when people wouldn't have been able to conceive a spaceship. Or maybe it was a creature who can move through different dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, a pterosaur-like animal has been reported in neighboring states like Wisconsin and Missouri. So, interesting. As for the beams of light, some believe bioluminescent bacteria is to blame. But so far, this is only found in some marine animals, some fungi, and other terrestrial invertebrates, like fireflies.
It was a firefly.
A huge firefly. But this cryptid does share similar characteristics with other cryptids. The description of the monster's body is similar to Mothman. Standing tall like a human, large wings. But the events in Van Meter occurred about 60 years before the events in Point Pleasant, which is Mothman's home.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they wouldn't have taken the stories from Mothman stories because it came before Mothman. The powerful odor that accompanies the Van Meter visitor is similar to the odor that is reported along with Bigfoot, Sasquatch, and skunk ape sightings.
Huh.
Today, Van Meter, Iowa celebrates the Van Meter Visitor Festival, occurring on one of the last few days of September, around when the monster was first sighted. The festival includes guided walking tours, presenters, food, music, movies, games, and much more.
I want to go.
I really do, too. So this year, the festival is scheduled for September 25th. And it's kind of, I read somewhere that they don't really, like, if you ask them, like, oh, what happened here? Like, do you know anything about the Van Meter visitor? It's not a super common thing that people know about. So if you live in Iowa and you know about this thing, let us know. But still to this day, about 118 years later, what those people in Van Meter experienced during those fateful nights in 1903 is still a mystery. So it has not been solved all these years later.
That's scary.
I know. And it's cool because I was like, all right, so last week I did something haunted. The week before that I did like a murdery type thing. And I was like, I want to do a cryptid.
Yeah.
And surprisingly, there was a cryptid in Iowa. And I was like, oh, awesome.
That's so, yeah. Okay. So that's how I felt about like my more sad stories last week. I was like, I'm not doing that again. So I totally feel that.
Yeah. So what do you think this thing could be?
I mean, so at first, it really made me think of their Jersey Devil.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
with the wings and stuff. Yeah.
And then I started getting really strong, like, Harry Potter vibes, which I know doesn't answer your question. But when you started describing, like, the lights and, like, the cave and just the people, I just was picturing, like, a scene from Harry Potter. I don't know why. And the wings.
And stupefy is also a spell they use in Harry Potter.
Is it really? That's so funny. Maybe that's why, too. It kind of sounds like a spell.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I feel like it could maybe be a bird and maybe they like actually didn't get close enough to it to know.
Yeah. But what about it emanating the light and the noise and the going in the cave?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
I don't know. That's creepy.
But it's pretty cool because it was only there for 5 days. That's it.
Yeah. That is very creepy. And also the whole time when the guy was like, he went towards the cave, I was like, why would you do that? Don't go towards the cave.
But it might have made him like, because like I said, all of the like toxic things were in there and all the bad smells and all the danger. And it's something like the noise still pulled him to the cave.
Yeah.
Which is kind of weird too.
Like possessed him?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's
in a way that
like he didn't have like a.
Yeah. Where he was like, awareness. I have to go to this cave and I don't know why. Oh, I know.
Okay, that was good.
Thank you.
I like that story.
I had a lot of fun writing it.
Yeah.
All right.
Cool. Hey, everyone. Have you ever had the idea to start your own podcast but had no idea where to start? We had no idea either until we found Buzzsprout.
It is hands down the easiest and best way to launch, promote, and track your podcast. Buzzsprout has made our experience with podcasting both fun and stress-free by listing our show on all major podcast platforms like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts, just to name a few.
You'll get a great-looking podcast website, audio players that you can drop into other websites, detailed analytics to see how and where people are listening, tools to promote your episodes, and much more.
Following the link in the show notes, lets Buzzsprout know we sent you, gets you a $20 Amazon gift card if you sign up for a paid plan, and help support our show.
Join over 100,000 podcasters already using Buzzsprout.
And remember to stay scary.
Stay safe.
So what are you telling us, Nora?
All right. So fast forward almost 100 years after your story.
Okay.
So 1998.
All right.
Bill Clinton is caught up in the Monica Lewinsky scandal.
Oh, God. Oh, my God. I'm sorry. Have you seen her tweets?
I have seen. I haven't looked at them in a while, but I've seen them.
Hysterical.
I know. They are so good.
Like, good for her.
I know.
But it's just, oh, my God, they're so funny. Like, she really plays into the part of, like, oh, yeah, I messed up here.
Yeah. Oh. I've literally had the thought before. Like, people are so harsh with her. And, I mean, you know, we don't have to get into that. But how much would it suck to be her?
Oh, my God.
Like, how much would it suck?
Oh, my God, stop.
I literally walked into that one. I walked into it.
Oh my God, I knew that was so bad. I'm so sorry.
Oh my gosh. So yes, Bill Clinton is busy with Monica. This Titanic is number one in the box office. And in Iowa, there is a 16-year-old woman named Jessica who just started dating a guy named Shane Hill. Mm. The two fell in love and were married in 2002 and had two children together. And a man named Daniel Blair lived with the Hills. I couldn't find details on, like, because that's kind of weird. Like, why is a random guy living with you guys? I think that he was friends with Shane.
Okay.
So he was just living with them, like, as a roommate, maybe extra money. I couldn't find any details on it. But he helped raise the kids when they were really little.
Wow.
But in 2005, Shane discovered that Jessica and Daniel were involved in an affair.
Uh-oh.
So Daniel moved out of the Hills home, and Jessica left Shane, and she and her children moved in with Daniel. Sounds super healthy, right?
Oh.
I know. After about 3 months, Jessica and the children returned to live with Shane, so their father. Shane and Daniel tried to repair their friendship, but they were unsuccessful. I mean, there's really no coming back from that.
No.
And it actually, when they tried to repair their friendship, it actually didn't help anything at all. It made things worse because the tension grew between Shane and Daniel. And according to an unnamed friend, the two, quote, always said they were going to beat each other up.
Tough words.
So, yeah. So, you know, not friendly things that you would say to a friend.
Friendly things to a friend.
I know, right? So now it's May 28th, 2007. Shane was working on a sheep farm, which was located at their home in Boone County, Iowa. And he often carried a pistol with him while he did chores and worked around the farm. At approximately 11:10 a.m., Shane called 911 to report that he had accidentally shot himself.
Okay.
Like, he's like, I just shot myself. He calls again 6 minutes later at 11:16 a.m. and is, like, calling for help.
Mm-hmm.
He died shortly thereafter.
Where did he shoot himself?
So, I didn't read, like, details of where.
Like, oh,
but I know,
gosh,
it was two bullets.
Okay.
Yeah. He died, like, right after his second call. Investigators reportedly found that Shane was attempting to shoot a dog at the time of his death. And in the 911 call, he reported that he had been struck by a ricochet bullet when trying to shoot the dog. So many feelings. Like, what?
Yeah.
And what investigators would find out later, though, is that the bullets from Shane's gun did not match the bullets found inside of him.
Ooh.
Yeah. And I'm just going to tell myself that, like, the dog was really old and sick, so he needed to shoot it.
Yeah.
Hopefully that's what happened.
Yeah, that's what happened.
Yeah. Jason Christensen, special agent with the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation, DCI.
I wonder how busy that organization is.
Oh, I know.
Right?
And another officer spoke with Jessica for roughly 20 minutes at the Boone County Sheriff's Office on the date of Shane's death. Jessica informed the officers that she did not know of anyone who had conflict with Shane. Jessica then volunteered the information that she had had an affair with Daniel in 2005, but stated that she and Shane were back together and at the strongest point of their relationship.
But, like, how can she not think that Shane has some enemy?
Exactly. How would you be so certain? Like, how would you really know, you know?
Yeah.
Very quick to say that. She also went a step further and told officers that she did not think Daniel was involved in Shane's death. And that she had last seen Daniel 4 months earlier when she saw him walking down the street as she drove through Boone.
Okay.
On May 30th, 2007, so now it's 2 days after Shane died, two officers spoke with Jessica and with Shane's parents at the Boone County Sheriff's Office. Terrence Kalman, special agent in charge with DCI, testified that he had brought the family in to have them listen to tapes of Shane calling 911. And obviously there was like a strategic motive of this.
Oh, yeah.
Kalman stated Jessica was, quote, stoic while she listened to the tapes and showed no emotion.
Hmm.
Which, and Crime Junkie talks about this a lot, like everyone shows grief differently.
Yes.
Which is something that is very true.
I get that.
But to hear someone's last moments and not have any reaction, yeah, that's like really wild.
Especially someone who you're, you know, still, I guess, married to, or someone who, yeah, you supposedly
like
love
the father
still
of your children.
Yeah.
So after the 911 calls were played, Jessica informed the officers that she did not want any more ballistic testing done on Shane's body.
I'd be like, do all the tests.
Exactly.
Do everything.
Like, I want to know everything. Even though they're thinking it's an accident, I want to make sure.
I want to know it's an accident.
Because what are the odds that a bullet ricochets back,
yeah,
at someone? Like, yeah, what are the odds? A day later, on May 31st, Kalman spoke with Shane's mother, Patty Hill, who informed him that she found messages from Daniel on Jessica Hill's computer stating he loved her, missed her, and would be with her soon.
Mm.
Patty Hill turned the computer over to the Boone County Sheriff's Office and gave them consent to, like, view and do whatever they needed to with the messages on the computer used by Jessica. And the messages also suggested that she was involved in an ongoing relationship with Daniel. After receiving this information, Kalman contacted Jessica and asked her to come to the sheriff's office for a third time.
Jeez.
Yeah, and at this point, they realized that this was not an accident and shifted to a murder investigation.
Dun, dun, dun.
Mm-hmm. So Brett Brofhart, an agent with the DCI, along with Special Agent Matt Sauer, interviewed Jessica at the Boone County Sheriff's Office for the third time. So this is their third interview, and this one was recorded. And the first approximately 8 minutes of the interview were later played for the jury at the trial.
I'm kind of concerned why the other two weren't recorded.
I think because at that point,
I guess if it wasn't a murder investigation, yeah, at that point,
they weren't quite sure what was going on. They, huh, didn't know.
Yeah.
Because she went in with his mom.
Oh.
Like, Jessica went in with Shane's mom to the,
yeah,
like, interviews.
So, okay,
they're not thinking anything crazy,
I gotcha,
yet.
Yeah.
So this interview was recorded because now they're thinking something's up with Jessica. And the first approximately 8 minutes of the interview were later played for the jury at the trial. And during the interview, Jessica initially stated that she and Daniel talked periodically after their affair for roughly 2 years.
Huh.
She also stated that after she saw Daniel walking by the side of the road roughly 4 months earlier, she contacted him and they got together once. Like, that is completely opposite of what she said before.
Yeah.
She stated this was roughly 2 to 3 months earlier and was the only time she had been with Daniel since the affair in 2005.
Okay, so we're getting some different stories.
Yeah, it's changing a little. She admitted she still talked to Daniel periodically on the phone, but she had not seen him since Shane's death. Officers were clearly interested in her relationship with Daniel at this point, and they informed Jessica of this because they believed it was more than what she was telling them. And Jessica said that she and Daniel, quote, did talk all the time.
Oh, my God.
So literally every time they talk to her, she's, like, giving them more and more.
Yeah, more times that they've talked.
Yeah. She admitted to meeting Daniel after work at his place.
Oh, yeah, I haven't seen him.
It literally went from, like, no contact at all, seeing him randomly on the street, to now they're, like, at each other's place, like, right before.
Yeah.
And then she also admitted that Daniel came to Shane's mother's home on the night of Shane's death.
Why?
I couldn't find any details about, like, what that meant or what happened.
Yeah.
But I think what's important is that he was around them very heavily.
Yeah.
And she admitted to having sexual contact with Daniel within the last 2 weeks.
Girl.
And then she continued and said that Daniel loved her and knew she was not happy with Shane, but also knew she would never leave Shane for him. She admitted to telling Daniel and others on many occasions that she wished Shane would disappear.
Oh, good.
Right?
Good.
But described these statements as, quote, things you don't really mean, but you say.
Yeah.
That's okay. Not going to look good for you, girl. Like,
no.
That's not going
to
look good.
Wanting someone to disappear? Like, that's not good.
How do people
good.
Disappear? How do you make someone disappear? There's only very, very small amounts of ways. But then Jessica told officers in this third meeting that she and Blair had messaged back and forth on the morning of Shane's death.
And who's Blair?
Oh, sorry. His name is Daniel Blair.
Oh, okay, okay.
So, yeah, his last name is Blair. So she told them that they had just talked back and forth, and they were literally inching closer and closer at this point to her finally, like, unraveling, because now they're at the morning of and they're talking.
Mm-hmm.
And anyways, so then she told officers that it was completely normal for her and Daniel to message back and forth.
Oh, so it's not just periodic,
exactly.
Sporadic,
it's like
times.
So many lies. I'm like, what? And then she said that morning when she was texting Daniel Blair, she was like updating him, like, okay, Shane just left for work and Shane's here, like giving him like a play by play.
And it's a normal thing that everyone does.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, what? But again, according to Jessica, this is normal conversation. She literally said this is like normal for us.
This
no.
legit is not.
Right. She then said that at one point, Daniel asked what Shane was driving and she provided that information.
Mm-hmm.
She also expressed again to Daniel that she wished she would never have to come home. Oh, sorry. She wished Shane would never have to come home. And this is all through like texts and emails. In total, it was 26 exchanged messages that morning alone.
Dang.
But investigators were unable to get the content of messages because they were deleted from Blair's cell phone, from Daniel Blair's cell phone. And the cell phone company does not retain the messages longer than 3 days unless asked by law enforcement through a preservation letter.
Wow.
Isn't that nuts?
I actually had no idea.
Well, I don't think it's like – it must have been like an uncommon phone company because I feel like you would hear of that more often if that was like a thing. The issue also is like they didn't suspect her at first. They thought it was an accident, so that delayed them putting in the request.
Yeah.
And so they were able to see that there were texts sent and received and see like those records. They just couldn't actually see the content. So it did help their case because it's like, why are they talking so much this
early?
Yeah,
so it helps. But also at the same time, it's just not giving that missing piece that you need.
Exactly. Because it's still kind of like circumstantial.
Yeah.
So then police asked her if she thought, whoa. Excuse me. Police asked her if she thought Daniel had harmed Shane, and she said no again. And then on previous occasions, she had told Daniel she would never want him to be the one who shot Shane.
We're just getting closer and closer.
Like, what do you mean? Why are you even talking about shooting Shane?
Right.
And then she says she did not tell anyone to kill Shane or pay for him to be killed and did not know anything about his murder and did not want it to happen. So at this point, she is like disassociating from it because she's probably realized like, oh my gosh, I look so bad right now. I'm just going to say all of this. But there's an important detail that hasn't been brought up yet, and it's that Daniel's roommate, Aaron Moss, has a huge part of this.
Mm-hmm.
So in May 2007, so right before the murder, Daniel and Aaron obtained a 30-06 rifle. I don't know what that means.
I don't either.
But on May 17th, 2 weeks before the murder, Daniel, along with an unidentified man, bought two boxes of ammunition that matched the rifle's ammunition. Around the time of Shane's 911 call, a passenger in a car saw a man who later identified as Aaron walking around the farmyard carrying a rifle.
Good.
DNA matching Aaron's DNA was found on the sling of a rifle from which a bullet recovered from Shane's body had been fired. Fingerprints made by Daniel and Aaron were also found on a box of the same type of ammunition.
There we go.
So,
the smoking gun.
Yep.
Wow, you're taking my job. I'm just kidding. I love it. Keep it coming.
I love it. So Daniel spoke with a friend, Lisa Lewis, the weekend before Shane's death and asked her to provide an alibi to him.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. He requested that if anyone asked anything about him, for her to say that she was with him all day Memorial Day, so May 28th.
Mm-hmm.
He then told Lisa that on the evening of Memorial Day, they had, quote, made someone disappear. Daniel texted Lisa later that night to inquire whether she had said anything about their conversation and to ask that she not discuss their conversation with anyone. Lisa talked to Daniel several days after Shane's death, and Daniel told her that, quote, they had shot somebody.
Oh my gosh.
Lisa testified that Daniel said they did this because, quote, they did not like the way he was treating his wife and they would be together no matter what.
Because that always works out. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Daniel kept going and told Lisa that, quote, Aaron pulled the trigger. And then Lisa testified when Daniel told her that they shot someone, she assumed he meant himself and Aaron. But the fact that Daniel said they,
yeah,
that messed it up.
Yeah.
That messed it up. So Lisa had been friends with Aaron and Daniel for several months and didn't know Jessica. And
several months. So yeah. She's going to take... Exactly. They're going to ask someone to be their, like, to be their alias, and you don't even know each other that long.
Stupefy. On June 8th, so about a week after the murder, Jessica was charged with first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit a murder.
Oh.
A jury returned a verdict of guilty of the lesser-included offense of aiding and abetting second-degree murder.
Dang.
Daniel and Aaron were both charged in connection with Shane's death and were convicted by the time of Jessica's trial, and they both received, like, really heavy sentences. Mm-hmm. And then in 2008, Jessica was sentenced to 50 years, and after 35 years served, she had the possibility of parole.
Okay.
So that sounds, like, pretty good, right?
Yeah.
Because she didn't actually pull a trigger, yeah. But, like, she definitely helped a lot.
Yeah.
Right? But Jessica appealed her conviction, which, girl, you're lucky you didn't catch those first-degree murder charges. And she pressed her luck. She fought the charges she got, and she argued quite a few things, including ineffective counsel, violation of Fifth Amendment, in which she claims she was being suppressed. So basically, like, when they interviewed her, she's saying that she wasn't read her Miranda rights and that she wasn't told that the interview was optional.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, if you look at it, like, completely objectively in the eyes of the law, like, that is kind of valid. Like, you yeah. have to read the Miranda
it
rights.
Is, yeah.
And I guess her lawyer didn't tell her, like, you don't have to talk.
Okay. So I guess that could be, like, bad counsel.
Yeah, exactly. She also claimed insufficient evidence. I think the reason she could claim that is because they couldn't actually read the texts.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And Lisa said that it was – he said they.
And also her fingerprints weren't found on anything.
Exactly. So basically it's all very circumstantial. Mm-hmm. I mean, it definitely points to her, but there's no hard evidence at this point.
Yeah, exactly.
And she did give them information. The only – it was incriminating information that she gave, but it was – when she wasn't read her Miranda rights.
Yeah, and then that so, is a whole different legal
exactly.
thing.
Exactly. So, and it's just crazy. Like, the thing that's crazy is that she admitted to texting, like, the play-by-play on the morning of Shane's murder to yeah. Daniel, but that got thrown out because of the Fifth Amendment thing. Isn't that crazy?
That is.
That's so nuts.
That is.
And then, so she was granted the second trial. And the reasoning was that testimony from a witness should not have been allowed, which was the one from Lisa. That's, like, the reason that they agreed to give a second trial.
I thought that was allowed.
Well, it was because Lisa didn't have anything in writing.
Oh.
It was all over the phone.
Okay, so, like, hearsay more
Yeah,
than
it was hearsay, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. The next line is, the court agreed with Jessica that Lisa's statement was hearsay.
Oh.
Yeah. Sorry, Lisa's stuff got thrown out, too.
Jeez.
And which is, like, kind of crazy because I feel like Lisa's statement helped Jessica, if anything, because
yeah.
it's, like, leaving Jessica completely out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, she wanted that thrown out. But you will never believe what she ended up getting after her second trial.
What?
Literally 12 years.
That's it?
Yes. She got 10 years and then a 2-year sentence to be served consecutively. And then this next part literally makes my blood boil. In 2012, she was allowed to do a work release program. So she is out of jail. She served less than a year of jail, got out, and is now doing a work release program.
So with that, does she, like, leave and go to work and then come back to the jail?
I think so, yeah. Like, you're still, like, in jail, but you can go out and work in the world.
Jeez. If I had that job, or if I had that, I would be working, like, 24-hour shifts every mm-hmm. single day.
No sleep.
Yeah. No sleep. I'm out.
Apparently, there's a Snapped episode about this
oh.
on Oxygen.
Okay.
And I really want to watch it
yeah.
because I can't believe this woman basically got away with murder. Not a very hefty punishment at all.
I don't know if you're going to come back to it. Are you going to come back to the 911 calls?
No.
Okay. So then how was he the one who called? Like, why would he have said in the 911 calls, like, I shot myself?
Because he thought that the bullet ricocheted and hit him.
Oh, right, right.
So he thought that it was literally an accident. Because at first when
so
I read that.
So it was just perfect timing that they were there.
Exactly.
Wow.
It's so crazy. And at first I was like, did they, like, hold a gun to him and tell
yeah,
the 911?
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking.
Yeah, because I was like, what are the odds?
Yeah.
That's insane timing. And honestly, it's just crazy that they really could have gotten away with it if they weren't so dumb. Because
yeah.
of him saying that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, fortunately they were dumb. And, you know, at least she did get some time. The other guys are going to be locked up for a while.
Yeah.
But, man, she really got off.
Dang.
Yeah. So that's my story.
Well, that was a good one. All Jessica. All Iowa people.
Ugh, man, Jessica. Just let the man do his sheep farming and leave him alone. Oh. That's all he wanted to do.
Just wanted to be a sheep farmer.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for listening, guys. Please send us scary stories and encounters and anything to ascarystatepodcast@gmail.com.
And follow us on Instagram @ascarystatepodcast.
And we finally got Facebook. Woo! So it's a Scary State Podcast fan group, I think. That's just what I labeled it, so it'll be easy to find. Join. Let's talk about your scary state. Let's talk about all the scary things.
Yes, please do. And then also, as always, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, because that would make us so happy.
Please.
All right, guys. Well, stay scary.
Stay safe.